33,000. Dar es Salaam movement, backed by the Yemeni army, has been defending Yemen against the Saudi-led assault, preventing the aggressors from fulfilling their objectives of an atrocious war.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. Bangladesh is reportedly set to move a second group of Muslim Rohingya refugees to a remote island, despite calls against the move by rights groups. Canada joins Japan and several European countries in detecting cases of a new variant of COVID-19, which was first reported in Britain. At least three people are killed and three others injured in yet another mass shooting in the U.S. state of Illinois. Welcome to the program. Our top story this hour, Bangladesh is planning to move more Rohingya refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal this month, despite calls by rights groups to halt relocations. Bangladeshi officials have been quoted as saying that around 1,000 refugees will be moved to Bahasan Char Island in the second phase of the relocations. Dhaka claims it is only moving people who are willing to move from the existing overcrowded camps that should be hosting over 1 million Rohingya. The UN, however, says it has not been allowed to carry out a safety assessment of where the refugees are actually being taken. Refugees and humanitarian workers also say some of the Rohingya have been coerced into going to the islands. Rohingya Muslims, mind you, were forced to take refuge in Bangladesh after a wave of torture and killings in neighboring Myanmar. They have refused to go back over fears of further violence. I was trying to understand this matter a little bit further with the help of Nay San Luen, who is a co-founder of Free Rohingya Coalition, who joins us via Skype out of the city of Berlin. Thank you, sir, for joining us. I'd like to get your understanding and perhaps your reaction to what I just read.
Thank you so much for having me here. So this will be the second batch. I heard on 29 they will be relocated to the remote islands of Bahasan Char. I think from 700 to 1,000. So this Bangladesh government has been planning to move, relocate the 100,000 Rohingya refugees since 2015. Just before arriving the 2017 refugee, about 750,000. So before that, there were about the 300,000 Rohingya refugee remained since 1991 and 1992. So about 35,000 were registered by the UNHCR, and the remaining were unregistered. So the Bangladesh government plan to move them there, but later in 2017, when they got the 750,000, and so they are now selecting the people from the 750,000. So according to the this first batch who were relocated to the Basanchar, most of them were forced to relocate. As yes, some of them voluntarily they agree they want to move there because the living condition is much better, but most of them didn't agree to go because this is far away from the mainland, and they will have not have the opportunity to come back to the mainland, and they will be isolated there. It's not like the prison, but and last year the UN requested the Bangladesh government to give them the technical assets. But unfortunately, UN didn't get the permission to visit the Basanchar. So, and also the international right group are keep objecting this, you know, not to relocate this refugee to the island. But the Bangladesh government is going ahead with their plan, despite their concern, and also the refugee have been keep rejecting this island since, you know, like 2018, when the Bangladesh government announced that, you know, the 100,000 refugee will be relocated, there. Since then, you know, they have been rejected. Only a few dozen, maybe, you know, they like the better living condition. But for me, if I have to say my opinion, I don't like at all, because it is completely isolated, and also there is a threat by the cyclone, and also it looks like the prison. You know, you have no way to go back to the mainland, and there is no public transportation at all. And we don't know, maybe the NGO now, you know, in the beginning they are there, the hospital staff are there, doctor are there, but a few months later they can despair, they can leave from the island, because this island is will be always threatened by the cyclone, and also it is very far away from the mainland. Nobody want to stay. And when the Bangladeshi foreign minister said, you know, that they will turn it to the resort or the place for the homeless people, even the homeless people didn't interest to move there.
Thank you very much. That's Nay Son Lwin, is a co-founder of Free Rohingya Coalition out of Berlin with that information. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's move on to another story now. Canada has reported the first two cases of a new and more contagious variant of COVID-19, which was first seen in Britain. The acting chief medical officer for Ontario said a couple diagnosed with the strain in Durham municipality with no known travel history or even exposure to high-risk contacts. The officer said the couple has been placed in quarantine now. He also called for the reinforcement of a province-wide lockdown to stem the new strain. Many countries, including Japan, China, Brazil, and several European ones, have already reported cases of the far more quickly infectious disease. They have also suspended their flights to and from the UK. Thousands of truck drivers are still stranded along the UK's border with France amid concerns over the spread of a COVID variant. The trucks are parked up on a motorway leading to the English port of Dover. Thousands of lorries, however, have managed to cross into France after authorities lifted the ban. The border was closed following the discovery of a new coronavirus variant in the UK. Britain has deployed hundreds of troops to help clear the trucks. The drivers now have to take a test, and only those with negative results can cross into France. The process has angered the drivers, obviously, who want to return home for the New Year holidays. One in every 1,000 Americans has now died of COVID-19 as the U.S. remains the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. With a population of over 330 million, the U.S. has so far witnessed more than 331,000 deaths related to coronavirus. Health officials in the country have also registered over 18.9 million confirmed cases. This comes as officials are bracing for a surge in infections following Christmas holidays. Meanwhile, the Central and Southern California regions have both run out of intensive care units. The state of California alone has so far reported over 2 million cases of COVID-19. Remaining with the issue, the World Health Organization warns that the COVID-19 outbreak will not be the last pandemic to hit the globe, calling for efforts to make the world a safer place for all.
It tells us that this will not be the last pandemic, and epidemics are a fact of life. But with investments in public health, supported by an all of government, all of society, One Health approach, we can ensure that our children and their children inherit a safer, more resilient, and more sustainable world.
The WHO chief also urged the world to boost its preparedness and potential to cope with coronavirus-like pandemics. He underlined that COVID-19 has messed up the world, leaving behind far-reaching consequences for societies and economies. We also noted that any efforts to improve human health are doomed unless they address the critical interface between humans and animals. The World Health Organization has taken an initiative called the One Health Approach. It aims to design and implement programs, policies, legislation, and research for several sectors to bring world countries together for better public health outcomes. No news of a shooting incident that happened in the U.S. city of Rockford, Illinois, has left multiple casualties.
In the city of Rockford this year, responding officers came to the scene. Calls were coming in. There was multiple victims. At this point, it's still an ongoing investigation. We do have three individuals that are confirmed deceased. We also have three confirmed other individuals that have received gunfire and are being treated at local hospitals. At this point, we have a person of interest in custody.
A Rockford police chief also said that a shooting suspect was taken into custody. The incident happened both inside and outside of bowling alley. Police believe the shooting was a random attack, but the motive remains unclear. No shots were reportedly fired by officers during the attack. It was not immediately clear whether the people who were shot were employees or patrons. U.S. federal agents are investigating over 500 leads in search for an explanation for the blast that rocked the city of Nashville on Friday. Hundreds of agents and local police officers are involved in the probe of the huge explosion that destroyed several vehicles and damaged more than 40 businesses. Three people suffered minor injuries after a parked motorhome in downtown Nashville exploded at dawn. While police say they have found possible human remains near the site of the blast, no fatalities have yet been confirmed. Officials have also stated that the explosion appears to be an intentional one. The city's mayor has ordered a curfew around the site of the explosion. Colin Campbell joined us earlier to give us an update on the explosion in Nashville.
Police don't want to overextend themselves when it comes to the details about this case. Now, they have narrowed down one person that they believe could be responsible for this blast. This was a man who owned an RV that was similar to the one seen in video just before the explosion in downtown Nashville. This was a guy who owned this RV and was picked up by a Google Maps camera. Yes, that's right. Those cameras and cars that you may see from either a satellite or roving around your neighborhood, when they pick up certain images, they pick up vehicles, they pick up mailboxes, they pick up how houses look. Well, this was an RV that was sitting in the driveway of this man of interest house. And so they went to this person's house. They are questioning him. They really aren't disclosing his name, although I do believe there is a name being released on the internet of a person in his 60s who's being questioned in this explosion. And again, this is only because this particular individual had an RV that was similar to the one that was seen in the video just before the explosion. And they believe that tracing back, looking at these photographs, they may have the right person. Now, again, this person is a person of interest. This is not a suspect, at least not right now. Police are not indicating that anyone was killed in the explosion. Before, there were some early reports that there were some human remains found from the explosion, but police are now saying that they don't believe anyone was seriously injured, or rather, anyone was killed in this, although there were some people that did report some injury.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to start the second half of the news with a grim one out of right here in Tehran. At least 10 climbers have died and several more have gone missing in mountains north of the Iranian capital, Tehran. Following heavy snowfall, rescue workers have retrieved 9 bodies from the Alborz mountain range, where the hikers were caught in a blizzard and a subsequent avalanche on Friday. One more individual lost his life in hospital. Red Crescent teams have so far rescued 14 people, with 7 are still unaccounted for. The search operation had to be halted at nightfall due to bad weather condition, but resumed at the break of day. Now, the Israeli army has carried out fresh airstrikes against the Gaza Strip, targeting several residential areas there. Ruba Shabat reports.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a wide air raid targeting various positions in the besieged Gaza Strip in the early hours of Saturday. The Israeli airstrikes caused damages to hospitals, mosques, and agricultural lands in the east of the Strip, and 2 civilians were reported injured. Israel claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza.
Targeting civilians in industrial areas indicates that the Israeli army has been encouraged by the recent normalization deals with a number of Arab states to further violate Palestinian rights. We will continue our resistance against Israeli aggression.
Resistant groups here stressed the Israeli army's crimes over Gaza and targeting civilians amount to violations of international law.
The Israeli army continues to commit crimes against our people. The airstrikes have frightened civilians and led to serious damages. We are facing a violent regime. The resistance, however, we respond in case the Israeli army continues its aggression. Resistance is our only weapon. We have to defend Palestinian rights. Netanyahu is trying to escape from his political impasse by stepping up pressure against us.
Palestinian groups say Israeli army should be held accountable for its crimes. Israeli occupation exacerbated the already dire condition Palestinians are living through, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic. The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing rocket fire from the enclave. Palestinians here say that Israeli army violates all international laws by damaging hospitals and targeting civilians. They insist their resistance is the only way to cope with the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Well, the year 2020 was filled with exceptionally significant incidents, from massive protests to war and destruction. Many people believe the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic could put a stop to these events, but, well, sadly it didn't. Let's take a look at some of the most noticeable incidents of the past 12 months.
Belarus witnessed its largest anti-government protests in history. The rallies started in the days leading up to and during the country's presidential election, in which Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko sought his 6th term in office. Tensions flared up in August when official election results were announced and Lukashenko was declared the winner. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, Lukashenko's main rival, rejected the results and created a council to challenge the president. But Lukashenko refused to step down, and protests, which often turned ugly, continued. So far, hundreds have been injured and many more arrested.
Kyrgyzstan President Sooronbay Jeenbekov resigned from power. Jeenbekov's resignation came after nearly 2 weeks of protests against the parliamentary elections held on October the 4th. Demonstrators believed the vote was unfair and rigged. Even though the result was annulled on October the 6th, people kept hitting the streets of Bishkek in protest. The rallies forced mass resignations that included the Prime Minister, the Cabinet, and several governors and mayors. Cities in France once again became the scene of violent clashes between police and protesters. Every weekend, people took to the streets across the country to protest against a bill which aims to regulate how people share films or photos of police. A couple of weeks later, more French people joined the rallies. This time, they were protesting a security bill the government said aims to fight what it calls Islamic radicalism. Protesters said the bill would discriminate against Muslims in France. The transition period for Britain to leave the European Union for good will end on December the 31st. The UK left the European Union on the 31st of January 2020, but leaders needed time to negotiate a trade deal for the post-Brexit era. So they got 11 months. However, the two sides failed many times to reach an agreement. They still need to finalise their negotiations on a trade deal, as well as resolve other issues such as fishing rights. If they fail to reach an accord, border checks and taxes will be introduced for goods travelling between the UK and the EU.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
It is hard to comprehend the magnitude of the crisis in Yemen. Approximately one child dies every 12 minutes in a country where 24 million people need humanitarian aid. Nearly 18 million people have no access to clean drinking water, a problem that will worsen in the future. For Yemenis, COVID-19 was only the latest epidemic. The country has in recent years faced outbreaks of malaria, dengue, and cholera. Even the outbreak of COVID-19 did not stop the Saudi-led U.S.-supported violence. As a result of new attacks, more than 18,600 people died between January 1st and December 5th, 2020, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, ACLED. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Isa Ferreira Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Yemen's Humanitarian Crisis Worsened Amid COVID. Stay tuned, please, for the details. For Yemen, 2020 has been an apocalyptic year, which has exceeded even the worst forecast for a country that has in recent years been ravaged by war and humanitarian disaster. Even the outbreak of COVID-19 did not stop the Saudi-led U.S.-supported violence. As a result of new attacks, more than 18,600 people died between January 1st and December 5th, 2020, according to Armed Conflict Location and Events Data Project, that is ACLED. In a 2018 interview, Robert Malley, who led the West Asia desk of U.S. National Security Council during the Obama administration, recognized that the disastrous consequences of military intervention by the Saudi coalition was a very likely outcome. He said, "It was the poorest country, Yemen, to begin with, being bombed by the wealthiest country in the region, that is Saudi Arabia."
Yemen has been the victim of a regional dispute, but also of Western powers. A coalition led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which the European Council on Foreign Relations describes as having access to some of the most sophisticated and expensive military technologies in the world, has been able to use the bloodiest tactics. As Martha Mundy, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at the London School of Economics, wrote in her report, the strategies of coalition in the Yemeni war, these include a blockade on sea, land, and air, which used hunger as a method of war, and indiscriminate attacks on the civilian population and food production. To commit such atrocities, the Saudi coalition needed decisive logistical assistance from countries including the United States and the United Kingdom. The consequences have been brutal. According to a report from April 2019 by the Paris Center for the United Nations Development Program, as well as data from ACLED, the death toll in the nation since the beginning of the war far exceeds 250,000 and may even be close to 300,000. It is hard to comprehend the magnitude of the crisis in Yemen. Approximately one child dies every 12 minutes in the country, where 24 million people need humanitarian aid. Donald Trump's foreign policy has repeatedly tried to undermine the humanitarian crisis in the poorest countries. Two such recent attempts were the efforts to suspend aid to Yemen in March of this year, followed by Trump's decision, announced in May, that the U.S. would leave the World Health Organization, which will have a disastrous effect if Biden does not rejoin the organization. The U.S. withdrawing its funding will translate into abandonment of millions of people who depend on these funds to survive in Yemen. These endeavors were unsurprising considering the Trump administration's support and its blank check for Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Meanwhile, there are high expectations for the new administration. Despite having been the vice president under Barack Obama, who supported the war in Yemen, Biden has been pushed to reassess the U.S. relation with Saudi Arabia due to pressure from progressives and unpopularity of the war. The war is not the only catastrophe to have befallen Yemen this year. Heavy rains between spring and summer caused immense damage and displaced 300,000. In fact, Yemen is a clear example of the tragic consequences of the climate crisis, the effects of which amount to more than just floods. Nearly 18 million people have no access to clean drinking water, a problem that will worsen in the future. For Yemenis, COVID-19 was only the latest epidemic. The country has in recent years faced outbreaks of malaria, dengue, and cholera. That latter is a perfectly preventable disease that should be eradicated, reminds us that while the world was seeking vaccines for COVID-19, people in Yemen were suffering the consequences of living without clean water. Worse still, the healthcare system in Yemen has practically collapsed. The extent of COVID-19 outbreak in Yemen is not currently known, but it is likely that the number of deaths in the country is much higher than the 607 deaths reported by WHO. Satellite imagery used to estimate the burials between April and September in the port city of Aden, but the excess mortality in the area at 2,100 compared to 1,300 deaths expected. The economy is also in ruin. Since 2015, the value of the Yemeni rial has fallen to $800, down by more than two-thirds of its pre-war value, while the population increasingly depends on the remittances that Yemenis send from countries such as Saudi Arabia. But these payments have also been affected by the COVID-19 crisis, as many overseas workers lost their jobs, meaning the money being sent home fell dramatically. The international community worsened the disastrous situation when it began to reduce humanitarian funds sent to Yemen. This has had dire consequences, and the United Nations has called for more funds to prevent humanitarian programs from collapsing, warning that millions of children are facing deadly hunger. Mark Lowcock, the UN's Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, warned that the humanitarian crisis in Yemen has never been worse, while the Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently claimed that Yemen is now in imminent danger of suffering the worst famine that the world has been in decades. As Lowcock said, Yemenis are not going hungry, they are being starved. Less than half of the humanitarian aid requested by the UN has been sent. That is, a further $1.75 billion is required. Meanwhile, tens of billions of dollars were spent on Western arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates during the war. This contrast invites reflection. The duty of democratic countries is to avoid unimaginable disaster. There is no time. Western governments must act now, by stopping sending arms and instead providing immediate funds to the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The United States has been waging a brutal campaign of economic warfare against Iran, also known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign. These sanctions have had a devastating effect on the country's economy and civilian population.
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Deal, was signed by Iran and the P5 plus one, meaning the United States, the UK, France, China, Russia, plus Germany. This agreement set out the framework whereby sanctions against Iran would be lifted in exchange for Iran curbing its nuclear capabilities. And indeed, Iran complied fully with the agreement. This was verified by the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And in 2016, all oil and financial sanctions were lifted, releasing almost $100 billion to Iran in frozen assets. However, in 2018, Donald Trump unilaterally pulled the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal, claiming that Iran was violating the agreement. This, of course, was not true, and no one shared this view, not the United States' own European allies, nor the international inspectors from the IAEA. The Trump regime then moved to reimpose crippling sanctions targeting Iran's oil sector, aircraft exports, precious metals, construction imports, and financial transactions. What the Trump regime wanted was to renegotiate the deal with Iran in order to dismantle Iran's ballistic missile program and to stop Iran from supporting resistance efforts in the Middle East. Effectively, what the United States did here is go back on its own word, not even 3 years after striking this deal, and then with such overt and brazen greed proceed to ask for even more concessions. This proves that there never really was an existential threat or fear of Iran obtaining a nuclear bomb like we heard so often and still do. What Washington wants is for Tehran to abandon its ballistic missiles program because this benefits Israel and Saudi Arabia. Moreover, Washington would love to limit Tehran and contain Iran's influence in the region, preventing Iran from fighting the illegal occupation of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq by the Zionists and the Americans. So, of course, the United States resorts to lies, to propaganda, and ridiculous smears using the mainstream media as its vehicle, which reminded me of the days in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 when they were constantly talking about weapons of mass destruction, 24/7. Now they have a new slogan, a new catchphrase, but for Iran, where they say Iran is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, and they try to use that in order to justify their imperialist aggression and conquest. Iran is no stranger to U.S. sanctions, but the Trump administration has been running what it calls the maximum pressure campaign, led by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. This maximum pressure campaign is designed to exert as much pressure and wreak as much havoc as possible on the economies of countries that the United States has targeted for regime change, just like Iran, just like Syria, Venezuela. And this always results in widespread suffering and death for the civilian population. Simply put, this is economic terrorism. This is a modern version of siege warfare, and it is cruel, it is inhumane, and it is illegal under international law. After leaving the JCPOA, we've seen the United States slap Iran with new sanctions almost every week. The U.S. has been so adamant in trying to put new sanctions on Iran that it even tried to trigger snapback sanctions at the United Nations Security Council earlier this year in August and bring back this UN arms embargo that consequently expired in October. This motion failed miserably, and it was a huge diplomatic embarrassment for the United States. Out of the 15 members who sit on the UN Security Council, the United States and the Dominican Republic were the only ones who voted for the resolution, with the other 13 members either voting against it or abstaining. This desperation was made even more obvious by the fact that the U.S.'s own allies, France, the U.K., and Germany, abstained from the vote. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Kelly Craft, insisted that they would be re-implementing U.N. sanctions on Iran, despite the U.N. not being on board and voting the resolution down. There were no U.N. sanctions returning on Iran. The arms embargo expired. But because there is such a lack of international support, in order to save face, that's what they've been saying. And it just proves how pathetic and farcical this entire campaign is. Just to further underscore how ardent the U.S. has been in its pursuit of economic warfare against Iran, Donald Trump's National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, even said that the U.S. has imposed so many sanctions on Iran that there's, quote, very little left for us to do. Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif tweeted a few days ago, quite accurately, I might add, that the United States is addicted to sanctions. I think that's putting it mildly. Just to further underscore this sustained campaign of aggression against Iran, not only did the U.S. pull out of the JCPOA, it also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The U.S. then flew a drone into Iranian airspace, violating Iran's sovereignty, and then issued a rebuke in response when Iran shot down, rightfully so, their unmanned aircraft. They've also threatened to pirate Iranian shipments of fuel to Venezuela, who's also struggling under brutal sanctions by the U.S. And in a separate incident, we also saw U.S. jets harass a civilian commercial airliner from Mahan Air that was flying over Lebanese airspace. These provocations are no accident and have been designed to complement this maximum pressure campaign. Nonetheless, the implications are not all military. The results of these sanctions can be felt in all areas of life. What the United States and their allies would like you to believe is that sanctions are some kind of harmless tool, a dull blade wielded in order to exert political pressure. But the reality on the ground is that scores of civilians end up starving and suffering and dying at the hands of these brutal sanctions, this economic terrorism. Let's call it for what it is. We've seen this before when the U.S. killed untold numbers of children in Iraq with sanctions in the early 90s. We're seeing this right now in Syria with the brutal Caesar Act sanctions, causing people to wait in breadlines in a country that was once self-sufficient in food. We're seeing this in Venezuela where people have no fuel and nothing to eat. 40,000 people minimum have died already because of U.S. sanctions. And we're seeing this now as well in Iran. We're seeing the effect there as well, where people are forced to go without medicine during a pandemic. Iran's health minister, Namaki, said earlier this month that the sanctions imposed on Iran by the U.S. have targeted medicine and medical equipment. Now, even though the United States claims its sanctions don't target things like medicine or medical supplies or food, European and other international partners end up being dissuaded from trading with Iran out of fear of retaliation and being slapped with secondary sanctions. In October of this year, the United States moved to sanction Iran's entire financial sector, blacklisting 18 of its banks, shutting it out completely of global markets and making it extremely difficult for businesses and, more importantly, for the government to buy medicine and medical supplies. How can countries like the United States and the United Kingdom profess to be liberal democracies who uphold international law and oppose tyranny when they are responsible for murdering scores of innocent civilians with their barbaric siege warfare? Never mind the wars, never mind the bombings, the drone strikes, the invasions. It seems that their idea of bringing democracy to others entails starving off entire populations and putting them through unspeakable misery. The fact that one would do this at any time is cruel enough. But the fact that the United States has not only continued these sanctions, but increased them during a global pandemic further exposes how brutal their foreign policy is and further proves this point. The United Nations and numerous other international bodies have all called on the U.S. to end its brutal sanctions, to end this ridiculous maximum pressure campaign amid the coronavirus crisis. Calls that the United States has completely and utterly ignored. The sanctions are so severe that they have spurred the growth of a black market, leaving Iranians without medicines that they desperately need or being forced to pay obscene amounts just to obtain them. How can anyone justify such economic and medical terrorism? We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now to talk more is Dr. Said Sarkar, Professor of Medical Physics at Tehran University of Medical Sciences. Thank you for coming on, Professor. I wanted to ask you, the United States claims that its sanctions don't target humanitarian goods like medicines and food. How have U.S. sanctions impacted Iran's ability to obtain drugs, medical equipment, and medical supplies?
U.S. sanctions really has paralyzed Iranian health sector. When they try to buy some special equipment or some pharmaceuticals or devices for patients, they are not able to do so. Although they say there is no sanction on health sector, but anyway, we cannot transfer money because all the sanctions through on the Iranian banks, which are not able to transfer money to the companies who they from they buy their facilities. So is that somehow that they say, okay, you are allowed to buy buy things or get hold of these pharmaceuticals, they block the way. So it's untouchable or unreachable, because if you want to buy them, you have to pay them, pay the companies. And also, the companies are worried after they say they will be punished by the U.S. Authorities. This is really terrible. This sanction has paralyzed us and has a profound effect on our health sector, and really people are suffering from these sanctions, and they have taken the Iranian nation as economic hostage, and really they are blackmailing Iranian population to impose their will on our nation.
I believe President Rouhani also said that these U.S. sanctions are preventing Iran from obtaining a COVID vaccine from the World Health Organization. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Yes, that's right. They are, they have been trying to buy this COVID vaccine from several weeks ago, and unfortunately, they have not been able to transfer money to pay for the cost of these vaccines. And also, as I mentioned, these companies are really worried about the punishment which will follow their business with Iran. And this is a bunch of lies that they deliver. And I don't know the American policymakers, especially President Trump, they are saying that there is no sanction on the health sector, but in reality, we cannot do anything regarding our health sector.
So, Professor, how has Iran managed to cope despite the sanctions? What is Iran doing? What kind of innovations have we seen coming out of this crisis?
At the beginning, we had a lot of problems providing PPE and also ventilators and other necessary consumables and drugs for our patients that really was hurting. But we are not going to sit and surrender. And somehow we thought that we should do something about it. And especially our knowledge-based companies started their R&D activities, and through technology development, we overcome some of these problems. For example, regarding facial masks, N95, since we had the technology on nanofiber technology, we were able, using nanofiber technology, to produce N95 and even N99 facial masks. At the beginning, our production capacity was about 20,000 masks per day, but fortunately, within 2 weeks, we increased our production capacity in 200,000 masks per day, because we had the technology and we were producing the industrial machinery and the production line. And Iran is one of the few countries who have the technology to build up this nanofiber technology, which makes us capable of producing N95 masks. And we are producing all hand sanitizers using nanomaterial like nanosilver particles or titanium oxide particles, and also we are producing air purification. And top scientists managed to make a system for detection of COVID patients. It's called the RDS, RAS detector, and within less than 30 seconds, using these nanosensors to detect those who are affected with COVID-19 virus. They dip the nanosensor inside the sputum. If the person is affected with the virus, within 30 seconds, the system will be able to detect the RAS, which is a byproduct of virus in the lung. So the patients who have lung inflammation, by the virus, this system will immediately detected.
And Iran has been developing its own COVID vaccine, correct?
Several Iranian companies are engaged in developing COVID-19 vaccine. Several of them are using virus or the kill virus. But two of these companies are using, the age of the technology, what the technology, and also nanolipid particles to produce vaccines like what, BioNTech and Pfizer or Moderna use the technology. And we hope that within the next 6 months, we will be able to start vaccination in Iran by Iranian-made vaccine, the top range of the technology. And fingers crossed, some of the companies have passed even an animal trial, and we need to do the clinical trial on people. And hopefully, we will be able to provide our people with Iranian-made vaccine.
In terms of regular medicines and medication, how much harder have they become to obtain? And how have U.S. sanctions impacted that?
Regarding the regular medicine, we don't have much of the problem because Iranian industry, pharmaceutical industry, is capable of producing ordinary or regular drugs. But regarding special drugs for, special patients in cancer or like hemophilia or some other special disease, there are severe effects on these groups of patients, which they cannot really find these drugs in pharmacies, and they need to go to black market and pay several times more to buy these drugs. So this is really hurting and has put a severe pressure on these innocent patients regarding, this is the result of what the U.S. doing with the ordinary people. And, it's really unbearable.
Doctor, thank you so much for your time and for all your hard work. I really appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much. The effects of these sanctions on Iran's economy are also undeniable. Just last month, Mike Pompeo was even bragging about how the U.S. has crippled Iran's economy by devaluing its currency, the rial, increasing public debt and inflation, and reducing the number of barrels of oil that the country is able to export. The fact that we regularly see the U.S. Secretary of State gloat about this exposes a shameless imperialist arrogance, how these imperialists are proud of causing the death and destruction of others. And it's important to note how everything is interconnected. Again, while the United States pretends that its sanctions don't target humanitarian goods, this is a flat-out lie and a denial of the reality on the ground and the suffering of countless people that is inflicted by the United States and their allies. Now that Joe Biden has been officially declared the president-elect by the Electoral College, one must ponder what lies next in terms of sanctions with the incoming Biden administration. Biden was vice president, after all, under Obama when the Iran nuclear deal, when the JCPOA was negotiated, and reaffirmed earlier this month in an interview with the New York Times that the U.S. would rejoin the deal if Iran adheres to the agreement. Once again, this is a bit of a nonsensical statement because Iran has always adhered to the agreement and protocols of the JCPOA, whereas the United States did not and tore up the deal. So it's frankly ridiculous that the U.S. expects something from Iran. It's on the U.S. to show some goodwill and prove that they can engage in long-lasting diplomacy, not the other way around. It's worth noting that we've seen calls from Germany and the United States that they want to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal, calling it a nuclear deal plus. But these are all iterations of the same thing. What they want is what Trump originally said, which is to curb Iran's ballistic missile program and to contain Iran's influence in the region and to stop it from resisting against the Zionist and American occupations. That's what it comes down to. They're all going back on what they originally agreed to, which is utterly absurd. Iran has made it absolutely clear that they will not renegotiate the nuclear deal. I mean, why should they? The P5 plus one couldn't even follow the original nuclear deal. Iran did and was treated with disdain in return. So as long as there's a clear understanding between the two sides that the sanctions are lifted, then perhaps there will be a return to some sort of normalcy in that regard. However, what a lot of media stenographers and some of the U.S. own allies are saying is that they want to renegotiate this deal, get rid of Iran's nuclear capabilities and ballistic missile program, and cripple the access of resistance. This is off the table, and that's not happening. After the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh last month, the Iranian parliament passed a draft resolution that sets out to enrich more of Iran's uranium up to 20%, which is much higher than the 3.67% set out in the JCPOA, and to beef up its nuclear program in 2 months' time. That time frame is no accident. What they're doing is essentially giving the Biden administration a chance to see if they'll lift any of the sanctions before actually going ahead with it. Now, President Rouhani has expressed concerns about the draft resolution and said earlier the U.S. will rejoin the Iran nuclear deal and lift all the sanctions. Iran's leader also addressed the topic of sanctions in a televised statement this week. He said there are two ways to tackle sanctions. Number one is removing them. Number two is to nullify and overcome them. He said that Iran tried the first option, tried removing sanctions by negotiating for a few years, but to no use. The second option, he said, may have difficulties in the beginning, but will have a favorable end. And indeed, that does seem to be what Iran has been doing. You know, what the United States and its Treasury Department did not consider is that Iran does not rely solely on oil. Iran has a very diverse economy with many means to fall back on and is able to barter and still navigate around the sanctions with other allies in the region and internationally. Even though the economy is in a bad shape because of the sanctions and people are suffering and dying, it is still a mark of resilience. And the country has been able to withstand sanctions, not just now, but for the last 40 years. This is something that Iranians, Syrians, and other peoples targeted by the U.S. empire know all too well. The United States thinks that it can cripple these countries